From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, with the rise of anti-Semitism around the world, we talk with the director of the American Jewish Committee's Berlin office about what they're seeing and responding to in Germany.
There's nervousness right now because there has been a resurgent right-wing. Various neo-Nazi groups, the equivalent of alt-right groups that are popular here in Germany.
Then for almost 60 years, scientist Merlin Tuttle has worked to change our perception of bats.
We just naturally fear most what we understand least. Every one of us is more frightened of getting on an airplane than driving to the airport, but we're far greater risk driving to the airport. And it's the same thing with bats. We don't know much about them, so we fear them.
Plus, we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Good afternoon. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The mass shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue was a stark illustration of anti-Semitism in this country. But anti-Jewish sentiment is not new. And as the recent picture of students at Baraboo High School giving the Nazi salute shows, it doesn't always manifest itself with murder. People who track hate acts and crime say that anti-Semitism is on the rise in Europe as well, especially with the rise of nationalist movements in places such as Hungary, Poland, and Germany.
The American Jewish Committee, or AJC, is an international organization that's into its second century combating anti-Semitism. Deidre Berger is the director of the AJC's Berlin-Reimer Institute for German-Jewish Relations, an office that was established comparatively recently.
I spoke with her at her office in Berlin during my recent journalism fellowship, and Berger explains the history of her organization's work in Germany.
You know, the American Jewish Committee was founded in 1906 to protect Jewish security and promote democracy worldwide. So it seemed natural after the wall came down to come to Berlin. AJC was actually founded by Jews of German descent, and to be on the ground as Germany once again has become a very dynamic democracy in the heart of Europe. It was important to us to support the re-emerging Jewish life here in Germany, to also underscore the importance of German-Israeli relations, and to work together with the Germans on transatlantic issues, on issues of the Mideast that affect us all, and really on supporting the values, the core values that keep us strong in the U.S. and in Germany.
How many Jews were here at the end of the war? There weren't that many German Jews left, were there?
No, we don't have exact numbers, possibly less than 10,000 Jews who survived in hiding, who somehow were saved by being part of families, non-Jewish families. There were really very, very few. But shortly after the war ended, many of the Jews from Eastern Europe who went back and realized that their families had been decimated, that they had almost no family members left, they fled to the relative safety of displaced person camps here in Germany. So oddly enough, there were more than 200,000 Jews just 2 years after the war ended living temporarily in Germany. Most of them left when Israel was founded. They went to relatives living in Australia, in the United States, Canada, wherever. But there was a small community of 10,000 to 15,000 Jews who remained in Germany after World War II, thinking very often that they would leave at some point. They didn't. There were less than 30,000 Jews in Germany when the wall came down. And then Jews from the former Soviet Union started coming to Germany after the wall came down, and Germany let them in. So today there's a community of 100,000 Jews that are registered, affiliated with communities, and probably about 200,000 Jews or more living in Germany again today.
Was there a resistance right after the war and then the decades after from Jewish communities anywhere to even come to Germany?
There was a lot of reservation in the organized Jewish world about whether or not Jewish life should be reestablished at all in Germany. But people make their own decisions, and there were Jews who stayed on because of the language, because of businesses that they had for whatever reason. And the recognition at some point was that there were small communities and they did need some form of support. But I think there was a lot of ambivalence in the Jewish world about seeing Jewish life reestablished in Germany. It took a long time and probably German unification to convince Jews worldwide that the German government was indeed serious about protecting and even expanding Jewish life again in Germany.
Do you think that reunification actually made some Jews nervous? Because I think it made some people nervous that this would all of a sudden become a military might again.
The unification of Germany in 1990 certainly made people in the Jewish community nervous. There was concern that Germany would again become quickly too powerful, and that a too powerful Germany would be susceptible to fascist right-wing ideology. There's nervousness right now because there has been a resurgent right-wing. Various neo-Nazi groups, the equivalent of alt-right groups that are popular here in Germany. But there are much stronger democratic institutions than there were in the Weimar Republic, and there's a very strong civil society. So I think we can't compare the two. Nonetheless, we have to be very alert. It's one of the things the American Jewish Committee does by being on the ground. We monitor the situation, we can keep people aware of what's going on, and we can work with partners on the ground to make sure that this sort of hatred of others simply will not again take over political life in Germany.
How concerned are you about the AfD, the AfD, which is the extreme right-wing party, which is now the primary opposition in parliament?
The AfD, the so-called Alternative for Germany, is troubling on many levels, also because they're trying to rewrite history. They're trying to come again with nationalist ideas, diminish the relative importance of the events of World War II, of the role of the Nazis. They're often trying to almost eradicate that history, to act as if the Holocaust was not a significant event in German history or in world history. It's troubling. That said, there's a strong democracy, and we believe that in the course of time, as people see more and more that the AfD doesn't have a lot of substance, that it's about anti-Euro, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, that it will keep them at least at a smaller part of the political spectrum. But there is concern about the impact their ideas are having, especially if they start foundations, once they start moving into the university levels.
Have they done that?
They're starting to. They're setting up their own political foundation, a think tank. They're working on reaching out to school children, to university students, setting up chapters. So I think this is not something, a phenomenon that will disappear quickly.
It seems so antithetical to everything that I've heard from so many of the Germans that I've talked to here who say that modern Germany is for peace. They keep stressing for peace, and yet we have this faction that seems to be gaining power. And I know most of the people that I've spoken to are very concerned, like you, about the rise of this populism. And so what is being done with organizations like yours, as well as with other governmental organizations? I know you talked in our talk about having lots of partnerships here. What are some of the things that you're doing to try to work against that instinct?
Germany, after World War II, said that one of the lessons was to emphasize at all costs a peaceful approach to diplomacy, that it was essential, even today most German politicians feel, to do everything possible to find peaceful solutions to conflicts. This is admirable. It doesn't always work in today's world, and there's a lot of discussion in Germany about the necessity of strengthening the military for defense purposes, but nonetheless of understanding that the only approach to solving world issues cannot, unfortunately, be peaceful mediation. Germany certainly tends toward that, and we're grateful on many levels. They're an important partner also for the U.S. in settling issues where they can, in finding solutions that will help end armed conflicts. And yet we see the rise of forces that are using violence on the streets, that are inciting people to be aggressive. It's a different impulse, and I think the two groups don't meet, and there's also very large demonstrations of exactly those people who want more peaceful resolutions of issues, who say if you don't agree with the immigrants, the way to solve it is not by becoming violent and attacking the homes of the refugees and attacking people. We need to find ways to talk about it, to settle it, to send those people back who don't have a right to be here, and to house and integrate those who do have a right to be here, who need refuge. It's a big conflict in German society to find a path moving forward.
You worked for a long time at NPR. I remember hearing you in the 80s and 90s and listening to your reports. You were here when the wall fell. How do you think journalism is reacting to all of this? Are we doing our jobs well enough?
I think it's much more difficult today for journalists to do their job. There was more of a consensus in the 80s, even the 90s, about what we stand for as a democracy and what are our values. And I think in all of our Western societies, there's more and more debate about how far we can go with freedom of speech, freedom of opinion, what are acceptable political views in a political spectrum and what aren't. So I think that that makes it much more difficult. There's also, because of social media and the whole web, people respond instantly and put journalists under pressure that I didn't face in the same way when I was reporting. That said, the role of journalists is more important, certainly not less important, in helping distill for the reader, the listener, the viewer, what's going on in the world and creating a framework so that we can understand it and make decisions about political steps to take moving forward. The conditions are not easy for journalists, and there's also a lot of attacks on the integrity of journalists that I don't think we had to that degree. Journalists were much more respected in the post-war age, the Walter Cronkite age. There was consensus. There were also many fewer outlets for journalism. People watched together. There was a common narrative of watching the three major networks. We don't have that anymore. We don't have those common platforms. So I think that journalists need to strive even more to find ways to reach the audience, to give them the information that's necessary so that we can all make informed political decisions about how we want to shape our society.
What is the greatest challenge that you think the AJC faces going forward, your work here, particularly in Berlin?
I think for the American Jewish Committee, raising our voices as an advocacy group, as a political group, is in some ways becoming more difficult because there's more and more suspicions of people working together, and particularly Jews working together, to help debate and define issues. I think that there is more anti-Semitism than there used to be. There's more mistrust of the fact that people who are part of a religious minority want to help ensure that we live in a safe world, that want to contribute to the transatlantic partnership and to ensuring that politicians are responsive to those concerns and to those needs that we have. AJC, fortunately, has very good access here in Germany. I think we enjoy a position of great respect as an old and honored human relations organization. But that said, moving forward, we're concerned about the place of Jews and minorities in European society and the issues of migration, of integration, and of identity. In an age of resurging populism and nationalism, where do minorities fit in? How can we be sure that democracy remains strong and that tolerance and acceptance and representation remains strong across the board? It's a big challenge moving forward and something we will work on for weeks, months, years ahead.
I was going to say, how do we do that? How do we make sure that those ideals continue?
We need to be more present than before, not less present. It's important to articulate our concerns and important to also call out what we see going on when we see it going on, and not to hide, not to be anxious, and not to feel threatened. And I think that's also a big challenge because there are more threats for journalists, for AJC, for advocacy groups who represent a position and a platform. We can't be intimidated. We need to raise our voices and be clear about our goals and look for partnerships in order to make sure that our understanding of democracy is not threatened, that we can live our lives in the way that we would like to, that we are in control and we don't allow other groups or authoritarian forces to take over and dictate to us who we are and how we live. It's really our identity and our liberal values that is at stake, and that needs to be part of our common struggle.
Deidre Berger, it has been such an honor to talk to you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Deidre Berger is the director of the AJC's Berlin Raymer Institute for German-Jewish Relations.
She spoke with me this fall when I was in Berlin for a fellowship through the Rias Foundation.
A quick break now, and then we'll speak with a scientist who has been working for more than a half century to change public perceptions of bats. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Do a Google News search for bats and see what headlines come up. Or we'll save you a few seconds and do it for you.
Some of the top news stories about bats from around the country include the following. Man touched bats because they were kind of cute. His death is a warning, family says.
Video shows bat with rabies, like the one that killed a Utah man.
And people are decorating for Halloween with dead bats. The CDC says that's a bad idea.
Dr. Merlin Tuttle has been working for more than a half century to change public perceptions of bats, first in his work at the Milwaukee Public Museum and more recently as head of the Austin-based organization called Merlin Tuttle's Bat Conservation. He returned to speak at the Public Museum earlier this week, and we reached him ahead of that talk from Austin. Merlin Tuttle, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity.
So I want to start with our humans' interactions with bats. How important in your work is the effort to change human attitudes towards the bat population?
It's extremely important. We just naturally fear most what we understand least. Every one of us is more frightened of getting on an airplane than driving to the airport, but we're far greater risk driving to the airport. And it's the same thing with bats. We don't know much about them, so we fear them. And unfortunately, people who fear bats can have devastating impact in harming our own future and economies. People who kill bats are basically cutting off their own noses to spite their faces.
Make the case for us. Why is it that bats are so important to us that we don't realize?
Well, for starters, it's been estimated that insect-eating bats in America are worth $23 billion a summer in crop protection. A study just published on Wisconsin bats showed that even ones that we'd not believed to be very involved in eating mosquitoes are eating mosquitoes that carry things like West Nile virus. Just one small bat can catch up to 1,000 mosquito-sized insects in an hour. They don't just eat mosquitoes, obviously. I know from past experience you grow a lot of corn in Wisconsin. Our free-tailed bats here in Texas may, in fact, be protecting your corn crops without ever even going near Wisconsin.
How do they do that?
Well, every spring, literally billions of corn earworm moths migrate into the U.S. from Mexico and Central America, and each moth is carrying between 500 and 1,000 eggs, and our bats fly thousands of feet above ground to intercept these invaders, and just one free-tailed bat here in Texas can catch enough of those moths in a single night to prevent them from laying up to 20,000 eggs on crops, and that's enough to force a farmer to spray multiple acres with pesticides at a cost of $74 an acre. Now, that's what's happening right here in Texas, but how it affects Wisconsin very likely is that we simply knock down the numbers tremendously before they start moving north.
Right, which so this is both much more environmentally friendly than using all this pesticide, but also a lot more economical.
That's right. There have actually been studies in other parts of the world, for example, a study not long ago in the Iberian Peninsula, the Mediterranean area, showed that just by putting up small bat houses strategically located around 12 hectares of rice crops, they're able to reduce crop damage to the point of not needing to use pesticides.
Now, you have been in this field for almost 60 years. What was it that first interested you in bats back in the late 1950s?
Well, I happened to live within a couple miles of a bat cave. Friends told me about it. I got my dad to take me there, and I was just incredibly fascinated by these creatures, and even more so when I found out how little was known about them. In fact, the books at that point said that the gray bats living in the cave near my home, didn't migrate, but I saw them plainly appearing every spring and fall. I got my mother to drive me to the Smithsonian and told the authors of some of these books that I doubted that they didn't migrate. They were impressed with my high school level investigation and gave me thousands of bat bands. I ended up, over a period of years, banding some 40,000, tracing them almost all the way to Kansas and from Kentucky to Florida, and found that they indeed did migrate. And that was, of course, quite an exciting thing for a kid. And I've been studying bats ever since.
Well, and do I understand correctly, in that era, the late 50s and early 60s, bats were facing kind of a precipitous decline in their population?
Well, they still are, but in the 70s and early 80s particularly, virtually everyone knew that all bats or most bats were rabid. In fact, as curator of mammals at Milwaukee Public Museum, I was frequently deluged with calls from frightened Milwaukeeans that they'd, you know, so much as just seen a bat in their yard flying over, and they'd call me and say, "Oh, I've got children. I'm so worried." And I'd say, what are you worried about? Did the bat do anything? Well, he flew near us. Did you hang around long enough to know he wasn't chasing a mosquito? And in those days, people in Milwaukee were paying $500 to have someone come from a pest control company and throw a canister of methyl bromide in the house. They'd have to move out for 3 days. And this methyl bromide is really dangerous stuff. When I checked on it, I found that it can dissolve the plastic insulation on electrical wiring and cause fire hazards. It can cause a human to become a literal vegetable without even having enough of it to smell it and know that you're inhaling it. And yet people would come back to their homes after these canisters were put in, and they'd say, "You know, the bats are still in the attic and the house stinks." And I'd say, "If the house stinks, you better get out of there in a hurry."
Yeah.
And in fact, I was the one that led efforts that got that kind of thing outlawed in the state of Wisconsin. In fact, it spread, and eventually this kind of thing was outlawed nationally.
And this was all in an effort to rid someone's house of an animal that probably wasn't causing any harm in the first place.
That's absolutely right. In fact, it was kind of, after a while, it got a little bit amusing. Sometimes the people that had the worst worries about bats in their houses were usually living on a lake. And, of course, there are plenty of lakes in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But there are the nicer homes on lakes. And I'd laugh and say, "Well, it sounds to me like you probably got one of those nice homes on a lake." And they say, "How did you know?" I say, "Well, that's where all these insects from mayflies to mosquitoes that bats like to eat live." I remember one couple out in the Waukesha area. They were getting a lot of news media publicity because of the ban on DDT, that they couldn't poison bats anymore in homes, and so they were overrunning the place and terrorizing their children, attacking them. And so I just showed up unexpectedly, actually with one of the little bats that was living probably in their attic in my hand. And they're so small that they couldn't see it. It was just concealed in my left hand. I came up and knocked on the door and announced that I was from the Milwaukee Public Museum and that I was an expert on bats and had heard that they were having a problem and wondered if I could help. And so all of a sudden, they were very happy to see me. And I talked to them for a bit, explained what was really going on. And they said, well, how can we, you know, get our children over it? They're just having nightmares. They're terrified. And I said, you know, the children are getting their terror from you. They're not naturally afraid of things like this. And I said, would it help if I showed them a live bat? And they were totally amazed when I opened my hand and said, here is one. This is what they're like. And the kids came up, and they took one look, and the little girl said, oh, he's so cute. And I said, well, they're cute, but don't try to pick one up. Any bat you can catch is more likely than the others to be sick.
So in those days, were humans the biggest pressure facing the bats?
Well, in the late 70s and early 80s, literally millions of dollars were being spent annually in killing bats in America. In fact, I would estimate that at that time, probably close to it. Well, just one company in Milwaukee was making $500,000 a year killing bats. So the slaughter of bats was quite incredible.
That had to be frustrating for you, given what you did.
Yeah, I mean, for anybody who understands these animals, I mean, they're incredible animals. They're brilliantly intelligent. They have social systems very similar to those of higher primates. They have very long memories. We've taught them unusual things in captivity, turned them loose, and when they're caught up to 2 years later, the same bat will remember what he was trained to do in just a matter of hours in captivity. They're really some of the most sophisticated, incredible animals on the planet. I train them routinely. In fact, many of the pictures that I'll be showing during my lecture at the Milwaukee Public Museum couldn't have been taken without me training bats. And I've even trained bats in the wild without ever catching them.
And that is a story I'm looking forward to hearing as well.
You'll hear that at my lecture. I'll show you the bat.
Outstanding. So you did this work for some years here in Milwaukee. Why was it important for you to pick up and move to Austin? Why has Austin been such an important place to be in the years since?
Well, what really happened was, you know, I couldn't be more appreciative of the 11 years of support I had as curator of mammals at the Milwaukee Public Museum. I had a great deal of freedom to do research, and that contributed greatly to my successful career. But I founded a bat conservation organization. At the time, you know, everybody thought I was stark raving crazy. Who in the world would found an organization solely to protect some of the world's most hated animals, animals that at the time everybody was paying to kill rather than to save? But as I did that, we started making a tremendous amount of progress, and it just started taking up way more of my time. You know, I didn't have time to be a curator of mammals doing full-time work for the museum and running a conservation entity. And everybody did think I was crazy when I resigned my very nice position there and moved to Austin. Now, why did I move to Austin? Because at that time, Austin was kind of almost the world center for bad publicity about bats. The Congress Avenue Bridge in the middle of our city had just been renovated, creating crevices in it that the bats liked, and hundreds of thousands of free-tailed bats were moving in. The national media were running headline stories claiming that hundreds of thousands of rabid bats were invading and attacking the citizens of Austin. And health officials were claiming that they were mostly rabid and dangerous. People of Austin were signing petitions to have them eradicated. But, you know, I knew this wasn't the case, and I figured that Austin might make a perfect model site for demonstrating that we can live safely with bats to great benefit. To make a long story short, today those bats attract $10 million in tourism every summer. eat close to 10 tons of crop and yard pests each night, and we're still waiting for the first person to be harmed by one.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you, if you were just a regular person, aside from shifting your attitude about bats, what are some simple things you can do to make the world a more bat-friendly place?
Well, you can start by just putting up a bat house in your backyard. The little brown and big brown, especially the little brown bats, have just had a terrible time with an introduced fungus that causes an ailment called white nose syndrome. And it's just passed through Wisconsin, and it's killing millions of bats. And it's not killing them all, but those that are surviving need maximum opportunities to live in good places without human disturbance. There's never been a time when they need help more, because their populations are, some of these bats are being knocked down by 90%. Mm-hmm. And just having a really good bat house available sometimes can be a big help. Beyond that, some of my other concerns involve things like careless use of wind turbines. They're killing hundreds of thousands of bats annually in the U.S. these days, and not enough attention is being paid to that. We discovered up to 10 years ago how to reduce mortality by more than 80% at less than a 1% reduction in power output. It's just that there isn't enough public pressure to convince some of these companies to actually make what everybody thinks is green, green. You know, these wind turbines aren't exactly completely green. They're killing large numbers of birds of prey in some areas, and they're killing hundreds of thousands of bats. But again, the bottom line is unwarranted fear of bats. People don't want to help what they fear, and they often end up killing what they fear. A lot of the stories that have recently appeared about bats paint them as being the equivalent of flying rattlesnakes, and I can't imagine anybody wanting a flying rattlesnake in their yard.
No.
I mean, there have been stories in the last year in the Wall Street Journal predicting that the next pandemic may come from bats. The ones who are propagating this kind of misinformation are invariably those who are profiting most from unwarranted public fear.
Well, listen, Dr. Merlin Tuttle, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for helping us shift our attitudes towards bats.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity.
Merlin Tuttle is the founder and executive director of the Austin-based organization Merlin Tuttle's Bat Conservation. He was curator of mammals at the Milwaukee Public Museum from 1975 to 1986, and he was back at the museum this past Thursday evening to give a Science on Tap lecture there. You'll find a link to more information about him and his work and the lecture at WUWM.com.
For hunters in Wisconsin, deer season began at Saturday's crack of dawn. It's a date on the calendar that moved Milwaukee poet Ed Mikowski to write.
A few years ago, I started deer hunting because I felt like if I was going to eat meat, I should at least try to have some part of the process. So as a 30-something, I went at this new adult activity with kind of the excitement that maybe, or the curiosity that a 14-year-old starts out doing it, who more commonly starts those things out with their family. So everything was new and surprising and startling to me. And the other day I was out in the woods thinking about all of the things that you're absolutely, certainly, unequivocally convinced are definitely a deer until they turn out not to be. So this one is called Orange Blaze of Glory. A squirrel bounding through fallen leaves is a deer. The groaning in the winds of a birch tree leaning against another shagbark hickory is the growl purr of a buck seeking a female deer. The flickering ruffles of polyester camouflage leaves on the hood of your coat are real leaves being crunched behind you by a deer. The woodpecker pattering its beak at beetles beneath the bark are antlers being rubbed raw by a monster deer. The downshifting of a semi traveling westward on Highway K is the guttural grumble of a buck attempting to charm a doe, a deer, a female deer. The suddenly wind-tussled brown husks of dangling remnant leaves don't know it yet, but they too, they're a deer. Oh, it was a deer, before you glimpsed the coyote arriving with curiosity to you mimicking the call of a female deer.
Milwaukee writer Ed Makowski reading his poem, Orange Blaze of Glory.
We will take one last break and then have our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
One.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time for another edition of Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined by our very special guest, as always, Leah Delaney, co-founder of Ex Fabula, in a very important week for Ex Fabula, very important time.
It is. It is. Needless to say, we are deeply saddened, and I think I can speak for the entire organization of Ex Fabula, of Bruce's passing this past week, especially myself, considering the fact that I've sat across from him for the past, 9 years or so. He's been a really great friend to our organization. He's so community-minded. I remember him reaching out to us and asking, what our deal was, basically, and if we wanted to start recording shows with WWM. And it just made sense. And we started out because today's show is remembering and celebrating our 10th season of Ex Fabula. We originally came in with a script, and so we handed Bruce a script, and I had a script, and we read the script, and it bothered him to no end. He's like, what is this robot stuff? And sooner than later, we gradually started to get to know each other better, and we built a really solid rapport with each other to the point where we were able to quote random movie references. Airplane was one of his favorites. And just share a general levity towards the short times that we had together on a weekly basis, all the while knowing there was something else going on. But I'm really, really thankful for that time to have with him. And I admire him. And all of our love and condolences go to his family and his friends. It's a huge loss to the city, for sure.
Indeed. Thank you very much. And my appreciation to him to bring us together in this context. And it speaks, that alone speaks volumes to the work he did with us. And we, of course, at WUWM are heartbroken. And so we are entering into this show as it's actually very fitting that we are celebrating the 10th season of Ex Fabula.
It truly is. Just starting from the beginning. We have a couple of stories from our past events, per usual. And the first story that we have today is from our very first event, which was in 2009. It was held at Art Bar on Burleigh. And here is Beth Lewinsky with her beginnings story.
Hi, everyone. Is that good volume-wise? Okay. Well, when I heard the theme was beginnings, it reminded me of my favorite quote about beginnings, which is actually from Steve Martin, and he writes, "In the beginning of something, its ending is foretold. And we met on an elevator going down." Which, incidentally, is how I met my fiancé, John, is on an elevator going down. I was at a conference for my university out of Indiana, and he was at a conference for his university out of Ohio, and we met in Virginia. I had seen him before the elevator. I had noticed in the opening conference that I was in that was far beyond my pay grade as someone who had worked for the Media Council for approximately 90 days. that he was paying far more attention to me than to the woman who was talking endlessly about PDF format. He took the elevator down with me from the third floor to the first floor, and his opening line to me upon staring at my name tag, which is an uncomfortable situation to be in when your name tag rests here, he said, "Ah, you went to Notre Dame. My mother went there." Also interesting, seeing as he was clearly 35 and Notre Dame had only been co-ed for 29 years. "Really, did she?" He laughed and said, "Yes, but she went to Notre Dame in Ohio, the college, not the university." And I said, "I'd hate to have to pay for the difference on tips." An inauspicious beginning, but he laughed harder than he needed to, and I knew something was up. Not wanting to be a conventioneer, nothing happened with John at that convention. A conversation or two in the lobby, an exchange of conversation in the hallway, always proceeded by my saying, "I'm extremely tired and I have a very early meeting tomorrow," which is hard to get away with when he's on the same schedule as you are. So, we said our goodbyes, and in the airport on the way home, I realized that the motto for Virginia was, "Virginia is for lovers." It was the beginning of my understanding that sometimes the universe throws huge, annoying symbolism right at you. A year or so later, in the course of my duties at my job, my boss asked me to find out about another conference that was taking place in San Francisco. I realized very soon that John, who I had not spoken to since, was the only person I'd ever known who had been to said conference. I IM'd him one day on his IM account and asked him about it. He very quickly, after two or three sentences, asked me if I was still as lovely as I had been in Virginia. It was the beginning of trying to understand how to take a compliment from someone you barely know. Very quickly after that, IM conversations became email conversations, which became phone conversations. And one sweetest day, I took a train from South Bend, Indiana to Cleveland, Ohio. It was the beginning of a much longer journey than the 5 hours it took on a train ride. After a few weeks of dating, very quickly, I love yous were exchanged, and a beginning of a whole new adventure, also known as meeting his parents. It was the beginning of my understanding that I should wait 3 seconds before speaking. However, I was told later that I was delightful. I wonder what else I could have said and been delightful. Later that year, John bought a house that I was to move into. I saw the house, and he said he was keeping certain rooms for my things, but there wasn't a lot of room for my things. I was very much in love, and that was my beginning of understanding that when the person is in the right place, very little other furniture is needed. However, it was also in some ways the beginning of the end. See, I lied to you when I said my fiancé, John, because John is not even his name. I lied to protect the absent, because one morning when he had arrived at my apartment to take my furniture to begin our cohabitation together, I woke up and he was leaving with only his things. It was the beginning of my understanding that all things are impermanent. But it was also the beginning of a new kind of life. It was a beginning of my moving back here to Milwaukee. It was the beginning of a career in comedy and theater and all sorts of things that would never have happened had he not chose to end our beginning there. And I also couldn't think it was a surprise, because after all, in the beginning of something, its ending is foretold, and we'd met on an elevator going down.
And that was Beth Lewinsky telling her beginning story at Art Bar. I feel like it's pretty fitting to mention that we are going to have a secret fabula, a members-only event. There are still tickets available for those, for people who want to sign up for memberships. It's going to be at Art Bar on November 18th, which is that Sunday. And there's going to be a whole bunch of real special stuff going on. There's going to be some trivia. There'll be ex-Fabula co-founders there kind of telling little behind-the-scenes stories and their favorite events and moments. And it's going to be really special. I'm obviously going to speak a little bit about Bruce and kind of talk more and kind of give a couple of my favorite stories about him as well. But again, you can get that information at exfabula.org. With that being said, let's just roll into our second story. Amy Losey's told a ton of stories with us, and this is one of them. she told this at our show and tell event, which was held at the Milwaukee Art Museum back in 2009. So here's Amy Losey.
Hi, I'm Amy, not the Amy that said it was that I would be the last storyteller, but I'm I'm a different Amy. And these are my crutches, and I brought them to show you. I got them about 6 weeks ago when I severely fell. I fell and severely broke my ankle. And because I have fallen and severely broken my ankle, I know a lot about severely broken ankles. One of the things that I know about severely broken ankles is that when you get released from the hospital, you get what is called a weight-bearing status. And some people are on full weight-bearing status, which means that they can actually walk on their ankles. Some people are on partial weight-bearing status, which means that they crutch and they can touch their ankles down. And some people are on what is called total non-weight-bearing status, like me, which means that I cannot touch my foot down at all for 8 weeks. So everything that I have to do that I do upright, I do on crutches now, or I do it on one foot. For example, if I'm going to take a shower, I can take this boot off, and what I do is I put my right leg, my right knee on my bathtub. My son installed this little, like, grandma safety handle for me on the wall. I hold onto that with my left hand. I grab onto the shower nozzle with my right hand. I flip my left leg over. I stand in my bathtub on my non-skid mat. I take my shower. Then I put my right knee on the bathtub. I hold onto the vanity, and I steady myself like this on the side of the bathtub, and I flip my left leg over, and voila, I have taken a shower on one leg. So I was out in California about 2 weeks ago at my sister's house, and I went to take a shower, and I went in there, and in her bathtub she had shower doors. So I was like, well, I can't take a shower in your bathtub because there's this ridge and I can't put my knee down and I can't sit on it. And she goes, well, you can go take a shower in my master bath where I have a stand-up shower. So I was like, all right, that I guess I can do that. So I go in, and there's a wall, like a little tile wall on the floor. It's about this high. So I go, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put my crutches in the shower. I'm going to crutch up and over the little wall, land on my left foot, put the crutches out of the shower door, close the shower door, take my shower, grab my crutches, put them on the bathroom floor, and crutch back out and land on my left foot. Easy, right? Okay. So I go to do it. So my sister leaves, and I get undressed and whatever. I go to do it. I crutch in. I go to stand on my left foot, and I slipped like on a banana peel. Slipped like that, okay? Like, woo! Like this. And instinctively, I put my right foot down, and electricity went up like my leg. And so I immediately lifted my leg up and somehow was able to like kind of catch my balance on my left foot. And I just stood there petrified. Like, oh my God, I can't move, because if I move, I'm going to have a horrific death naked in my sister's shower in California, you know, on one foot. I don't know what to do. So I'm standing there like, my God. And literally, I swear to God, 5 hours goes by. It's probably 5 seconds. But in my head, it's 5 hours. And I'm thinking, I'm going to die in the shower. I'm going like, Sue. And she's out by the pool, and no one's coming. So I kind of think, okay. So what I did was I lowered myself down with my two hands like that, and I sat down in the shower, and I turned around. I scooted out on my butt, and I got in my bathing suit, and I went out. I crutched out to the pool. I laid down on a lounge chair, I put a towel over my head, and I told my sister, I am not moving out of this lounge chair for the rest of this trip. You are going to have to carry me out to the car, and I'm flying home in my bathing suit, because I literally am not going to move, because I'm going to die if I move. And she goes, Amy, really, like, let's think about this rationally. How many times have you actually fallen in the last year? So if I was to ask you, like, how many times have you actually fallen in the last year, you might have to think about it. Some of you might say none, like my son goes, none. And so some people would say none immediately. Some people would have to think about it maybe once or twice or whatever. So she asked me this question, and immediately I say six. So she goes, which is sad, but it's also interesting, because I knew instantly that I had fallen six times, you know. So the weird thing is, not that I've fallen six times, which is sad, but it's true. And the weird thing is that I realized is that if you had asked me how many times have you fallen after the fifth time I fell, I probably would have had to sit and think about it for a while, and I would have maybe said, I don't know, two or three, I'm not sure. I'm not, you know, maybe a couple, I don't know, whatever. But because of the sixth time I fell, which is where I got these crutches, I knew that I had fallen six times, and oh my God, you guys, please, please pray for me that there is not a seventh.
And that was Amy Losey telling us her show and tell story that she originally told during our first season event, which was held at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We're celebrating our 10th season with Exfabula. And we just couldn't do it without you guys here at WUWM. And again, without Bruce, he was the one who originally tapped us. My radio buddy. I love him. I miss him. And we're just very thankful to him and helping us, you know, go through these past 10 seasons, for sure.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on.
Thank you, Rachel. And I look forward to sitting across from you.
Thank you.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and it's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now. All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock.